Hello, everyone. It's great to be sort of gathered together. I'm presenting here, and Mark Chmielewicz unfortunately couldn't join us today, but I was hoping to sort of lead us through this discussion. The format, we had so many great comments from you all from the pre-meeting survey that I just tried to kind of collate what you all the points you all made, and then I have some specific quotes that I pulled out as well, and hopefully that kind of launches a good discussion about some of the challenges that we face in doing prevention trials, and then some I thought a lot of great ideas for how we can sort of do better in StrokeNet 3.0, as we're calling it. So at this point, we've had some pro you know we definitely have had progress with prevention trials. We've completed several prevention trials. We're making good progress despite the COVID challenges on other trials, but obviously it's tough, right? We know that doing these long-term trials are not easy, a lot of challenges. So let's launch into it and see, what have we learned from our experience so far? What are the ideas for doing better? When we were crafting the survey, Mark and I sort of framed five questions for everyone. What are the biggest obstacles? What are some potential solutions to doing prevention trials? And then sort of specific questions about what about these smaller rural hospitals that don't have as much research infrastructure? How do we provide access to those patients to participate in research? How do we benefit from having those patients be involved? And we asked about telehealth and how to sort of make, increase the use of that for doing prevention trials. And then the EMR, pretty much I think more and more places are using some format for electronic medical records. How do we use that to our advantage in doing prevention? So these were the five survey questions. And we had a lot of answers to those. So let's start with the biggest obstacle to prevention trials. So these are my groupings that I sort of came up with based on the comments that everyone made. A lot of comments about funding. And then there was a lot of challenges with recruitment. So in recruitment here, these were comments about just the inherent challenges of, finding patients who are eligible, persuading them to join the trial, then challenges with local infrastructure, right? So this ranges from everything from IRB issues, regulatory issues, having the team of coordinators, coordinator turnover, retention, et cetera. Then there were a lot of comments about the challenges of retaining patients, participants in the long term. And I think that's one thing that'll be good to talk about today. A lot of comments about about protocols being overly complex and not being pragmatic enough. And then comments about the challenges of recruiting a diverse, set of participants. So let me just show you some of the direct quotes, and then it'd be great if people want to start coming up and sharing their thoughts or questions about some of these comments. But a lot of challenges with putting together and keeping together teams of PIs and coordinators. Comments about the protocols, right? Inclusion criteria not being realistic, too narrow a population, too complicated protocols, too many assessments. I thought this last comment kind of, the whole shebang right there, right? We need a lot of participants, budgets, there's competing trials, particularly industry trials, finding a diverse group of patients, coordinator turnover, too many trials. And then there was, I thought, interesting comments about, what should we be handling as a stroke community? When it comes to prevention, what falls within the purview of a neurologist? What is within the purview of a primary care doctor? Do we want the PCPs? There were comments both that they're too involved, right, and that they're not involved enough. So how do we deal with that? There's just not enough stroke neurologists who are interested and trained to do research. And then, multiple trials of the same or similar therapeutic strategy has not been successful in adjacent populations. So like, why are we testing it here? So let me pause here. What do people think? Does this seem to capture the whole set of obstacles? Anything that's left out? Anyone have any other comments, questions, reactions?
I will still.
Oh, go ahead, Joe.
I was going to say, start calling on people if not. So,
yeah,
I just keep thinking over and over again because it came up in the recovery survey responses too. It's this whole like transitions of care, and you talked about that with the PCPs a bit, but this whole issue of they get inside the SNF or the acute rehab and having the resources for them to buy into being a study site and then trying to convince them to administer the study meds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and, for Aspire, for Arcadia, I mean, we definitely dealt with these. And a lot of times, like even when you can get buy-in from the facility at the leadership level, the day-to-day administration of the drug can sort of fall through the cracks. So definitely a big challenge.
Hi,
Hey, Shadi.
Shadi Yagi from Brown. I just have want to make 2 points. One is getting PCP approval, for studies that have like a short enrollment window of like a week. It is an obstacle, for us to get in touch with the PCP. Often, like they're busy, they'll call us back after the enrollment window. So, that's one of the obstacles. The other one is some of our patients go to rehab. They're in a long-term facility. Having them administer study drug, has been another challenge. So I'm just wondering if, you or anyone else has any input on these two. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good comments about potential solutions we'll turn to next. But any other, did we leave anything out? I want to feel like.
Scott Kessler again. So I guess many of the trials that we've done so far have had an enrollment window of 3 or 6 months, which feels long. We all see lots and lots of very chronic stroke patients. We haven't really done a trial for like that population. The cardiologists do this a fair amount where like any history of prior coronary disease. And just sometimes it's a budgetary issue, right? The events rates are probably higher early on, and we want to like keep our sizes down. But this feels like an obstacle too to prevention trials of really having to try to get these patients in early on and seeing if there's a way to have a broader view about prevention.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm curious if people have thoughts on that. Do we think it would help to have a longer window? Because I think there's some, I'm just listening to all the comments like the earlier session now. I mean, there's just trade-offs with everything, right? So I think having a longer window definitely would be helpful for some cases, but also I think for some trials we've found that the earlier you approach patients, the better. And like once you let them leave, then it just gets harder. The event rates, I don't know. I mean, looking at some of the Kaplan-Meier curves for, like some of the at least the ESUS trials and Arcadia, I mean, it's pretty, maybe there's a little bit of a drop off after first year, but it kind of is goes up pretty linearly.
Good morning, Anish Singhal from Mass General. It's been my observation that despite of what we think are robust screening procedures, the maximum enrollments occur when the totally invested site PI happens to be on the inpatient service. I don't know what the others feel, but as I step into my new role, I'm thinking of creating a more tiger team approach with the faculty who are primarily inpatient 10 or more weeks a year to be the site PI. And then if the four of us collaborate, we would cover maybe 40 weeks of the year. I don't know if you guys have had the same experience about enrollment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the secret, everyone knows it, right? It's the sort of the sustained attention to actually looking and approaching and having the conversations. And I think the sites that perform really, really well somehow are able to do that just, 24/7 or at least every day. It's tempting to have these periods where you're just like there's other things going on or the PI is not on service and it sort of waxes and wanes. But how we incentivize and help sites keep up attention like that is key.
I add on that, I think one of the biggest obstacles is site buy-in by having the fellows, the residents, other attendings. If they're not helping screen patients and talk to them, you're not going to enroll. So.
Cheryl Bushnell with Wake Forest. Back to your point about what is the optimum window for enrollment, I think you have to balance the kind of the wake-up call that the patients experience because they may be more motivated, but they're also overwhelmed with all of the therapy visits and all the other visits. And so it's really challenging, but we found that at 60 days was probably about a good amount of time to get patients into a secondary prevention trial that's focused on blood pressure, but probably would get even more if we had 90 days. So that's just kind of a compromise that we came up with, just to allow patients to recover enough to the point where they could even think about being in something like a trial.
That's a good point. And yeah, I mean, and maybe, you know, it's just like there was comments about, you know, overly strict protocols. Maybe it's just, there is an unnecessary upper bound. If there's a patient who's eligible and willing, and why are we excluding someone who's willing to participate, you know, on day 61, it does seem a little bit unjustified. Carla?
Hi, Carla Sherman from Weill Cornell. I just want to comment on the having an attending available. Very long time ago, back in the day when we started clinical trials, we actually had a stroke service. And so our attendings would take a week or a month, and they would just be available to come and talk to patients. We actually had a stroke clinic with the attending was doing stroke clinic for follow-up patients on all the trials. And it worked for us really well. That was in San Antonio. I think a problem right now is after COVID, a lot of the docs work remotely. So setting up that kind of schedule is a little bit more challenging, but.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the team approach is super key. And we see that with all the trials, right? The sites that enroll well, they it's like a team approach for sure.
So this actually is good off of that last person's, what she said. So I'm Jenny Majerzyk again from Utah. And I have noticed over the last 10 years that our new hires, our trainees are very interested in only inpatient care. They're not actually interested in outpatient care anymore. And I would say that at all of my satellite sites, very few stroke neurologists actually conduct clinic. A lot of it is pushed to general neurology or to advanced practitioners. And I'll just say that at my site, I only hire people who will do both. I think it's really important for us to follow up our own patients. And this sort of parrots after what Dr. Kramer and others were saying about people not having exposure to recovery. If a stroke neurologist isn't actually in clinic, I think it's very hard to enroll in a prevention trial. It's one thing to do it in the hospital, but I think as Cheryl was saying, the sweet spot is after the hospital. And if our people aren't in clinic, how are they supposed to get people into the trials? So for us, I think that's been a real help, which isn't to say that we're the best enrollers in all of these, but we're there, we're physically there. And I think as a field, it's a problem when we're training people to only push lytic and to do the acute stuff, and we're not training them in secondary prevention. I have a lot of soapboxes today.
No, that's it. Yeah, I think that's, yeah, you're totally right. And we see that at our site as well. I think it's really a point. Dana?
So Dana Parker from Weill Cornell. This is not so much as about an obstacle, but as a separate unmet need that I think at least ought to be discussed, which is that in a lot of the prevention trials, there may be a role for genetic studies as a supplement to the trial. And I think it would at least be worth thinking about in StrokeNet 3.0, the idea of having some more formalized way of making that it possible for that to be a part of the trials for anyone who is enrolled. And I think it applies a lot to prevention, but certainly it could also, it applies almost equally to rehab or to acute trials. So I think that's something we ought to be thinking about, not for any one trial specifically, but more generally.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I just wanted to respond to that to say, remind everybody, you know, there are ancillary proposal, you know, it's a formal mechanism for our StrokeNet trials. And so that is an avenue potentially to do, say, a genetics endpoint. And in fact, right now there's a discussion going on for Verify and putting in some genetics. So that path exists. So hopefully that inspires some people.
Well, from the University of Washington. Something that I've noticed over the years is that even if a stroke neurologist goes to see a patient while they're in the hospital to try to enroll them in the trial, I would admit to days where my enrollment game is good and my enrollment game is not so good. And it definitely affects whether a patient says yes or no. And that's sort of the whole argument about being generous to participate in research. I think it applies to every study that StrokeNet ever runs. And I guess I'm wondering if there would be an option for StrokeNet writ large to create a video that's available online that even includes patient testimonials for people that have participated in trials to show the value of trials. And it will prevent me from having as many bad days in enrollment because there's a uniform approach, and we could probably review it iteratively to make it better and better over time. And I'm just wondering whether that would help a little bit with enrollment really pretty broadly across the StrokeNet trials.
Yeah, that's a great point. So we're going to jump to like potential solutions. That idea of outreach and advertising, I think, was raised. And I like that. It's a very specific example of something you could do, right? The patient testimonials. All right. So I think this is great. Let's move on in the interest of time. So potential solutions, right? So I think we have a good sense of the obstacles we face. And so here are the sort of comments that you all entered in terms of solutions. I have to say, I was a little surprised by the large number, like the sort of cry for simple, pragmatic trials. But that there were a lot of comments about that, right? Make the protocol simpler, make it more pragmatic, have platform trials. So that was by far the most popular answer as a potential solution. And then a lot of comments about collaborating with, you know, other services, PCPs, cardiology, public health, et cetera, outreach into the community, outreach to patients, and then advertising, right? Mm-hmm. Just having a better way of explaining what the benefits of research are, why it's important. I think David gave a good example of something we could think about. Increased reimbursement to the sites for enrolling, as well as increased patient compensation. I think that's one lesson we've been learning in StrokeNet is about adequately, you know, compensating patients for their time. A lot of comments about remote platforms, using tech more, using the EMR, and we'll get into some of the challenges for that. I mean, it sounds great, but how do we practically start doing that? Comments about more in-person meetings for trial site, you know, trial-specific investigator meetings, training. So David was talking about how do we make sure that we have a standardized approach that we can sort of, you know, learn from the best among us about how we present trials to patients. And then a few comments about sort of a different payment model by like standing salary support as opposed to per patient reimbursement. And then some specific comments, which I thought were really interesting. So I love the idea of the stroke mobile or the stroke van. So the RCC would just have like a team of experienced coordinators going around to you know, sites that have less research infrastructure, right? So we bring the expertise to patients. It's sort of like have you guys seen this, like the mobile thrombectomy teams that fly out to the patients. So it would be like the research equivalent of that. And then again, just pragmatic trials. Please, you know, you follow standard of care as much as possible. We need the review panels to approve pragmatic trials. Some calls for just taking over control of which trials are funded, which I think is some logistical challenges there about bypassing study section. But again, you know, engagement with other fields, public health. I like this comment, more diversity in what constitutes a trial. We talked yesterday about some, you know, looking at implementation science, pragmatic trials. Maybe we could broaden our scope of what we should be testing, right? Rather than the traditional, like, here's a pill, here's the placebo, we're going to do a double-blinded trial, maybe being a little bit more open-minded. And then to Jenny's point, right, about evolving the job description of stroke neurology to focus on the post-stroke period, right? And you know, are there opportunities that we're missing out on because we, as a field, and look, I'm not pointing fingers. I train in neurocritical care. I don't see outpatients, which Carla, you know, highlights all the time. It's a challenge. I regret the decision, but as a field, though, you know, we there's are there things that we're not we're not doing because we still are deferring to the primary care doctor, right, to manage the blood pressure or the, you know, the cholesterol, et cetera. So I think there were a lot of comments about that. Going global, right, doing more, like baking into the trial from the beginning that we were going to have international sites. So these I thought were really interesting examples of solutions. But what are people's reactions to some of these comments, especially the pragmatic trial piece? I'm curious what everyone thinks about that, because obviously there's trade-offs there too, right? And you know, I think in the previous panels, we talked about collecting more data, more granular data, which is obviously scientifically very helpful. But how do we square that with this kind of call for more pragmatic, simpler trials that follow standard of care?
Sundarajan from University Hospitals in Cleveland, at Case Western RCC. I think there's always a trade-off, right? If you have a very pragmatic trial with very broad inclusion criteria, you risk not being able to answer your question because you're not specific enough. And so I think it's easy if you're just trying to enroll more patients to say that you want broader criteria and more pragmatic trials, but I'm not sure it's going to really answer the question in the end that you're trying to ask.
Yeah, very good point. Brad, I think you're...
Yeah, so this doesn't address the pragmatic trial issue, but the Discovery trial has done something very interesting in terms of coordinator support that I actually think particularly prevention and possibly recovery trials could take advantage of. They actually look at the percent FTE over the lifetime of participation in the trial and have compensation correspond to the burden of work that the coordinators need to do. So early on, when you're just recruiting those first few people, the coordinator support is lower. In the middle phase of the trial, when you're still recruiting people and you're doing all of the late phase assessments, there is more support for the trial. And then as it tails off, it tapers again. And I am unaware of any of our prevention trials doing that. It tends to be a per patient payment. But given the fact that our coordinators are in fact enrolling in multiple trials across time, this might be a model that's worth thinking about.
Yeah, that does sound very interesting. Because I think there's obviously challenges with the per patient model, right, that we're all aware of.
Hi, my name is Mark Harrigan. I'm at UAB, and I just want to speak to the outpatient versus inpatient thing. I'm a neurosurgeon, and so there is no separation between inpatient and outpatient. I've always thought it's a curious quirk of the vascular neurology culture that people are allowed to only see inpatients. You know, so I think maybe this is an opportunity to StrokeNet to leverage its influence over the stroke community and maybe broaden stroke neurologists' practice to include outpatients routinely.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think that definitely came out in some of the comments. But yeah, what do people think? I mean, it'd be great to discuss that a little bit more.
Yeah. Right. Ron Lazar, also from UAB. So we asked these very complex questions in our phase 3 trials. And speaking to coordinators, they are incredibly burdened with trying to collect all these data to answer all these nuances. And as PIs, we're interested, but they're less invested in, I think, some of the subtle questions. So I think one solution to the pragmatic trial is to put more emphasis on the phase 2. If phase 2 was done better with a good biomarker, then in fact, you're really answering a very important scientific question. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to phase 3, the pragmatic issue, does the therapy work in the community? And I think it would take a burden off phase 3 if we made our phase 2 a little bit more rigorous.
Right. So it's a more detailed in a smaller sample and then go pragmatic in the large one.
Hi, Jeff Saber, UCLA. First, let me reassure a neurosurgery colleague that the great majority of vascular neurologists are seeing outpatients each and every day. Two suggestions about things that could help. For the idea, I love the idea of a stroke van that could go to different sites, and that the commando model of dropping in on sites works for acute as well as prevention and recovery. But a regulatory challenge is the business associate agreement that allows outside personnel to come into hospital Currently, the national legislation says it cannot be used for research, at least regulation. It has to be used for a non-research business purpose. So if NIH could take up change that, that would really make it more feasible. Another suggestion with regard to retention is, I think for trials where we're following people for years in prevention, it'd be helpful for StrokeNet to come up with a set of monthly emails that have general stroke information and rah, rah, great that you're in the trial, retention messaging that could be used in every trial. Instead of each trial having to come up with its own, one set could be used across all trials, and the same for acute trials for 3-month follow-up to keep people in.
That's a great point. I think that speaks to David's point as well, having like a standardized approach that to the every trial doesn't have to sort of solve it on their own. Can I just ask the Cincinnati team about the, because don't you all go to the other hospitals like in within Cincinnati, and how do you solve, is it because there's a clinical agreement you for clinical care and then you, because I think yeah, there's just so many logistical barriers to these things that seem like a good idea, right? Like the stroke van, and people make comments about that too, but you'd have to solve all the IRB issues. Like what's the IRB jurisdiction of the van, right? Yeah.
Actually, just sent you a question about that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering the same. So we don't drop for acute enrollments, we don't go to the hospitals as much anymore. We used to, but it's now mostly telemedicine. So just like everybody else.
Okay.
But the question that I had was, and actually I had another comment, so I'll save them both. But the question that I had was, there are some sites in our network that we don't have a trial agreement with. We can't go do research there. We are credentialed at all the hospitals in the region, so we could go there, but we don't have research agreements with everyone. And my question was, how do you work with the IRB to be able to at least advertise that you're doing clinical research? And if patients wanted, because I know you can't just cold call, but if someone then wanted to give Abby a call and say, I'm interested in this rehab trial, I'm interested in the secondary stroke prevention trial, what is like the regulation around that? That was my question. My other comment was just to some of the previous barriers that people are finding in the outpatient setting. So we have the same issue with trying to get patients enrolled while inpatient because it's just so busy and patients are in and out so quickly. Like it's a goal of the hospital, right, to get patients out. So to do things like Sleep Smart, where you need 2 nights in the hospital, and other trials as well, the secondary prevention trials, how to get to patients who are discharged so quickly. So we do have nurse practitioners, APPs, that see patients within a week or two of discharge, and we screen those clinics, and we're often in those clinics trying to get patients that we missed while they were in the hospital setting. So that is a solution that we're finding more and more useful to talk to the patients when we're in them, give them a brochure, or talk to them about a trial. And then when they're outpatient and they're with family members, we can talk about it at a more like leisurely pace, then we seem to be able to get some patients enrolled in that setting as well.
That's a great point. Yeah, we set up a transitions of care clinic as well. It's been super helpful. Like patients come back within a couple of weeks, and that's a great time to talk to them. Dana, I think you were waiting.
Yeah, just on the subject of kind of designing pragmatic trials, but ones that can actually answer specific questions, it might be worth designing a trial that is broadly inclusive, but is set up so that it has well-defined sort of pre-specified subgroups to be looking at within that. So you can enroll lots of patients all into the same trial, but then have enough patients and enough power to look at specific groups within the larger set. So I think that might be worth thinking about, to have a trial that's easy to enroll people in and also collects enough data in the long run.
Dr. Kamal, this is Varsha Singh from St. Joe's, New Jersey. I'm a stroke neuroscience nurse practitioner. So my engagement with NIH Stroke Net started 4 years ago, and I was looking for an algorithm. Step one, I do this. Step two, step three. I figured it out. The WebDCU is like really a gold mine for a lot of us. But my suggestion is, if we can create something like an algorithm that you need to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 CTAs, agreements, CIRB. That would really help people who are coming on board who are new. The second suggestion, I just wanted to say that there are other interdisciplinary team globally within the country, such as I would really bring up American Association of Neuroscience Nurses, a great potential with that organization if this this body can have a table and ask us what we do. Because I know that this is a very well-known organization among scientists, neurologists, neurointerventionalists, but I'm not sure about that particular body who can be really a support system for the research that we are conducting in this area. And the last one, I'm sure NIH Stroke Net Table will be at the International Stroke Conference in Phoenix next year. That's where we have an ability to engage more people. And lastly, there are many public and social organizations who are also engaged in stroke research. For example, I'm part of the South Asian Total Health Initiative, which is out of Rutgers University. And we did stroke research for 4 years. It was all about community stroke education, but they are again not connected with NIH StrokeNet. So we do have potential. And the last one, social media. I wanted to ask, do we have an Instagram or do we have a LinkedIn where we all can connect, where we have an ability to ask a simple question, not confidential or private, but just connect with each other if we wanted to reach out.
Yeah, no, lots of great. Yeah, I think there's plans for more social media presence going forward. I know of trial specific, like in Aspire, you know, we set up a WhatsApp group that I think is helpful for like rapid communication. And then I think you mentioned training. I think there's going to be more of a platform for, you know, coordinator training, like with some of the stuff you mentioned. So I think those are great, great ideas. Speaking of,
So one area that I wanted to mention that we talked about at the research coordinators meeting is that, you know, we put all this time and effort into screening and there's no reimbursement for that. You know, we talk to patients, they may say no. And so maybe thinking about it for future trials, if there's a way to like, you know, have a certain number, like if you've at least talked to X number of patients in like a monthly period or quarterly period, we've had some sites who kind of like fizzled out because they're like, you know what, we're doing all this work, but yeah, we don't get a patient in. So if there's some way to add a little bit more financial incentive for even just trying to find these patients, I think that would really help to keep sites engaged and continuing with trying to recruit.
Yeah, I was gonna put in a plug. Absolutely.
I think I mentioned this yesterday, so you might have it's hard too, but as part of my new role with the budget trial budget planning, in at least the new trial templates that are being used for the submissions for the past year and a half, we have increased, kind of have put a screening as a line item. So I usually meet with the PIs and understand how pragmatic their protocol is and usually recommend at least 90 minutes to a couple, 3 hours of screening time per patient. So it's there. We have updated our hourly rates as well on there for coordinator time compensation and annual maintenance for continuing reviews and things like that as a separate kind of yearly fee as well. So none of those trials are approved yet, but they're all in the new proposal. So hopefully that will help for the upcoming trials.
Wayne from Duke. I just want to add a little bit of discussion on the research event. I think it's a great idea. It is likely a solution. We can increase the diversity of enrollment and really reach out the rural community. So at Duke, North Carolina is a very rural area. So I've been really spent efforts looking into that. I actually got someone agreed to donate a van. Our regulatory barrier is really the van has to be part of the institution. And then we have a telestroke network. Half of the sites, they have research capacity. The other half, they just don't have research capacity. Yeah. It can take years. So the only way is that we can reach out to them. If we can't enroll them, we just have to enroll those patients remotely, then follow up with them using research van. Other barriers are really to find one person who can do everything. And there's also some liability issue. But I think this is one of the solutions. We really should create a task force really looking into this.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll do two more comments and then, in the interest of time, Carla, you're next.
Sherman Cornell again. I'm the nurse coordinator. And I think one of the things is slightly cumbersome. Understand cardiology buy-in for the anticoagulant trials, but for some of our trials, we have to manage blood pressure control. And some of the docs are willing, the neurologists are willing to change blood pressure medications. Others want to turf them to the PCP. And that gets, I think, a little bit cumbersome. And I don't know if there's any rules or regulations. Like, you know, Dana will change medications, but some of the other docs won't. And so I think that's, you know, like maybe some, does it need to be standardized?
Well, I'm curious. I'm going to just do a quick poll. So how many, can we get a show of hands of how many of the stroke neurologists like take primary control of the blood pressure management? Okay, and how many sort of make recommendations to the primary care doc or the cardiologist? Or so I think there's just a lot of variability.
I think
right?
it varies. Like in my practice, I think when you know they need to get their blood pressure started, you treat and you start them. You don't wait to see the PCP, which could be weeks.
Right.
But I think when you start to infringe upon the PCP's role, as that's one of the things they do, unless it's a very complicated patient, you want to be sensitive to that.
Right,
so it's
right,
a combination.
Right.
I think most of us do some prescribing, but we're ultimately trying to defer to the primary doctor with that eventually, unless it's really complicated. And then we're saying they probably get a different physician to manage that complex blood pressure.
Right.
But then you could never get the blood pressure.
Carla, that is beyond StrokeNet. You're talking about practice of medicine in the United States.
Yeah.
And that is a big one. There's things we can figure out. Know what you can do and know what you can't.
Yeah.
So
okay, I'm going to do one more comment because we got it. We still have three more topics. So just real quick.
So hi, Chris Drive, University of Minnesota. I just wanted to say a couple of things. Hopefully, I'll remember. In terms of a van, we actually do have mobile phlebotomy that goes into the community to do follow up blood draws. And I'll volunteer Abby's to guide us, our project manager, if anyone wants to ask about that. But it is really nice for our patients. And then just comments on two things that we do as a response to things that I've heard. Our expectation on stroke service is that you will screen and enroll. It's not an option if you you want to enroll in a trial or you're the PI of the trial. The expectation on service is that if you have eligible patients, you will approach them and offer them a clinical trial if they're eligible. You know, in terms of, you know, if you get a lot of enrollments or not, I mean, some people are interested, some people are not. What you can do is present it to all the patients who are eligible. It's one of their treatment options. And so we don't have a patient for, would be Captiva eligible, for example, who is presented dual antiplatelet for 3 months and the Sampras type management. And then someone comes in later and says, oh, do you want to be in Captiva? There's this trial. We present Captiva and the conventional management of intracranial stenosis, and explain the differences between the two and why we are running the trial and what we're trying to do. And this is not just the expectation of the attendings, expectation of the fellows, our APPs, and the attendings. And we train them to do that. So our fellows who come in are trained on all the trials. They're trained on clinical equipoise. They're trained on the underlying physiology and data that supports that. And I think it's really important for our program to do that, not just because we want to enroll trials, which of course we do, but when you have that as a standard for the program and for the patients that are seeing, or for the providers that are seeing patients, when your APPs can talk about ESUS and why Arcadia is not an ESUS study because it's an atrial cardiopathy study, and they have that understanding of stroke, it's a really high level of practice. So we really like that, and we push that, and that's the expectation on all of our services. The other thing is we cover multiple hospitals that are not where we're at physically, which I know more and more places are starting to do, the big inpatient telemedicine programs. And we also enroll and recruit at those sites. And I think some of what the University of Minnesota has in terms of how we're set up enables that. We do have sort of a shared pharmacy that will train pharmacies and non-academic sites how to give study medication. It's actually not very complicated, but you know, if you're in Arcadia, you don't order Eliquis, right? You order study medication, and they have to do in services, but they have been supportive of that. We just enrolled, I was talking to Joe, we just enrolled the fastest patient over telestroke at one of our community sites the other day, And, you know, our standard really is that if we're going to apply this level of care to the patients that we're seeing in person, yes, it can be done over telemedicine. It can be done remotely. And there's a lot of advantages to being in research to the patients too. And, you know, we want to equitably offer that to everyone we see. So we do try to like push down some of those barriers. And I think, you know, the fact that you see someone and they're on Telestroke, you're like, hey, this is a great fastest candidate. I mean, we should really be trying to offer that or secondary prevention as well. You know, you see someone at our sites and they have intracranial atherome, we should be able to try to offer them enrollment in Captiva. And for us, this is actually good for diversity. If you look at the state of Minnesota, it just happens to be very Caucasian. Some of the sites that we're covering for telemedicine are more diverse sites, and we're getting enrollments from those sites that, you know, may reflect the broader stroke community a little bit better. Thank you.
Very cool stuff.
Three minutes.
So 3 weeks. So I'm going to run through the rest of the survey responses, and then if there's any last thoughts. So speaking of that, how to expand to network to rural and small sites. So by far the most common question was, you know, we need better remote tech approaches. Requests for RCC resources so they can help train the local sites, finding local champions, training the coordinators at those sites, maybe some kind of certification program, right? So that staff at smaller hospitals can get certified in doing research and get, you know, regular training. Again, pragmatic trials, the travel van, et cetera. Those are common answers. Centralized consenting. I think like what Chris was talking about, how do we set that up? And I think it'd be great. And one of the things that came up was for sites that are figuring it out to share it with other places. So like, it'd be great to hear more details about how you guys are knocking down some of those barriers. Again, the stroke mobile, traveling research coordinator. And then what are the barriers to some of the telehealth approaches, right? Because it sounds great, but logistically it can be difficult. So there's the issue of the digital divide, right? Patients, particularly in rural areas, not having access. And that's a much bigger problem, I think, as Joe said, than maybe just stroke. But there's a lot of site logistical barriers, right? Regulatory issues, IRB issues, lots of comments about how specific hospitals, like there's just these rules that you can't do this or you can't do that. It's not clear why. Lack of any kind of good platform. Maybe these are things that can be solved at a central level. A lot of comments about there are no barriers. We should be doing it more, right? Why aren't we doing more? Protocol barriers. Some trials are still requiring in-person assessments, et cetera. Here are some like specific comments. You know, Jenny had brought up the difference in payment for remote versus in-person. And then just, you know, not having a HIPAA compliant platform, licensing issues, a lot of these sort of logistical issue barriers to telehealth. And then the last thing we talked about is, you know, how do we leverage EMR? All these things kind of overlap, right? But needing help to sort of facilitate the use of the EMR. So, you know, on some of our calls, our trial webinars, Real Heal, people say, oh, we set up this great tool in Epic that tells us this. And a lot of us are hearing that saying, that sounds wonderful, but I have no idea how to do that at my site. So it'd be great to have some kind of like clearinghouse of tips where, and I know Epic is, you know, different at different sites, but there's probably some commonalities. Figuring out better ways of capturing data, especially outcome data. A lot of comments about we need more interoperability, which again, I think is a bigger issue than just with research, but if there's creative ways of addressing that. And then some notes of skepticism, right? That like, if we just move completely towards capturing outcome data from the EMR, or can we really trust the data, or is it just too noisy? So here's some of the specific comments, right? About how to abstract outcome data. Maybe instead of just using the raw EMR data, maybe you have a template that your physicians are, when they see a patient, there's some fields that they automatically fill in with maybe the MRS or other measures, more detailed measures, et cetera.
Last slide. We're at 12:15.
Last slide. This is it.
All right. Yep. So great discussion. Yep. Very robust. Houman did a great job. Thank you so much.
That's a good discussion.
And it's Karen, you're up.